six listeners can't be wrong.
Yeah, six listeners cannot be wrong. Rob Wolf.
Andy Dees. The Paleo Solution.
Holy cow. Gads.
Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, back with episode 60 of The Paleo Solution. I think this is the last episode of 2010, Rob. What is going on with you, man?
Well, you know, we should name this one the gambling episode because both Andy and I are in the great state of Nevada. Andy's in Vegas. I'm in Reno. Who knows what could happen?
Well, you know, I learned in Vegas, like, we went out to dinner on Christmas Eve last night, recording this on Christmas Day, and it was like 11 o'clock before we actually started eating. So here, you know, I haven't been having much caffeine. I'm like, holy cow, I need to have a coffee if I'm even going to make it through the appetizer. Like, this is like, it's 11 o'clock. This is ridiculous.
People don't even come out until like midnight in Vegas. So
I know.
That's when the day starts there.
And my mom was kind of horrified. Like, who are these people gambling? And, you know, the casino we're at is like one of the local ones for the locals. So there's not like high rollers or anything, just some of the local folks like doing a normal Christmas Eve thing for them. It's just like all these grandmothers and, you know, husbands and wives just hanging out playing, you know, slots and stuff. And my mom was just like horrified by the whole thing. So it was pretty amusing. And right now, as I was saying before we got on the call, you know, my brother's prepping some bison and some beef tenderloin and some lamb and some foie gras. So Christmas Day dinner should be excellent.
Nice. Right on.
Do you guys have any snow?
We have a little snow in Reno. Okay. Yeah. The last time that we were here, it was a literally almost Donner Party trying to get back into California. So it looks a little bit mellower this time. So
being it's the last episode of 2010, Rob, anything you want to add before we move into the new year?
Oh, man. Let's see here. We're going to be Paleo Solution is going to be featured in Us Weekly on December 29th. And I think Us Weekly is slightly above the National Enquirer in quality of journalism. But I'm grateful for anything that we get from anybody. So that's super cool. And then Art Devaney and I are going to be interviewed pretty soon on Sirius Radio. And then I'm going to be on Jimmy Moore's show again. I think he's recording that January 3rd. December 31st, and then I'm not sure when that goes out. So a couple of cool things like that going on, and just loads of shenanigans. So how about you? Anything else you want folks to know about?
No, although we've gotten several more messages, so we're still researching the transcription of the shows, and it will be occurring. After this goes live, that Tuesday, whatever day that is, which will be the 28th, we will close the request for questions for Matt Lalonde, because at this point...
It's been an avalanche, folks.
And I don't know if he's actually paying any attention, or because I, you know, Sarah Fragoso, prepping for her episode, you know, she's very organized and paying attention. I don't know what Matt's got going on this month, so he might not even have looked at him yet, but there's some doozies in there. And even some people are like, you know, if someone else posts a question, someone else would respond, oh, that's so much better than my question. You can skip mine if you'll answer that guy's question. And I'm like, oh, my Lord, poor Matt.
Yeah, it's going to be dogpile on that. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, maybe a multi-part episode. We'll have to see how it goes.
Yeah.
Cool. Other than that, man, I think that's it. You ready for some questions? Final questions.
I'm ready to roll. Let's do it.
All right. First one, question from Stanley. Rob, I've read your book, and it really opened my eyes. As a result, for the last few months, I'm eating 100% to your recommendations. I'm getting 2.5 grams of EPA DHA per day from fish oil, which admittedly may not be to your recommendations. I'm exercising smart for once in my life and not wearing myself the hell out with long, slow runs and or grinding weight room strain sessions. I've always slept like a champ, but now I sleep like a champ in a totally blacked out room. Last August, 4 months ago, my numbers that I got from my yearly physical were total cholesterol of 178 with an LDL of 113 and HDL of 38, triglycerides in the 130s, and I think it was around 135. That was my last fasting lipid panel. Last week I donated blood. I fasted as usual, so the total cholesterol might potentially be indicative of, I don't know, something. My total cholesterol came back at 233. They didn't break it down in any way, so I only received total cholesterol numbers. Here's my question. Should I blow this off and not worry about it? 90% of me says to blow it off and pull off worrying about any such numbers, whether it be LDL, HDL, any subsections of these, or anything else related. What is your opinion? For what it's worth, I'm 44 years old, 173 pounds, 5'10", am in good shape, and spent a good deal of my adult years as a professional boxer, which is to say I've always worked out and been fit and in good shape. I grew up boxing in the amateurs. I've never in my life not worked out in some form or fashion. Thanks in advance, and thanks to Andy for reading my question. Thanks to everyone in the Paleo community, and thanks to anyone else I left out, Stanley Stryker Mead. And a follow-up note, he said, sorry to add more here, but I really should point it out that every other tested or doctor inspected thing about me is really good. My glucose, blood pressure, etc., all good. It's only this total cholesterol of 233 that seems potentially out of whack. Thanks.
You know, really good stuff, interesting stuff. I would definitely follow up on this. Like in the original blood panel, and granted, we don't have a lot of the stuff I like to see, like the LDL subfractions, C-reactive protein, A1Cs. But the triglycerides are pretty damn high. Like triglycerides of 130 are way higher than what I would want to see. And it would lead me to think that the LDLs would be problematic. The HDLs are actually a little bit on the low side. Still back and forth on whether or not any of that stuff really matters in the grand scheme of things relative to just inflammation in the body, which we could track via like fibrinogen and C-reactive protein and whatnot. But I would definitely follow up on this if for no other reason, just establishing a benchmark and pull right out of the book or what we have on the website, which is get that additional information. Look at the LDL particle size, look at the A1Cs, look at C-reactive protein. I would make really sure that the testing that they're using is capable of distinguishing the VLDLs from the LDLs and whatnot, because when you start taking fish oil, and actually when you start getting healthier, some of the triglycerides can then get counted as VLDLs or LDLs. So it's a kind of a dodgy thing there. You need to make sure that the instrumentation is actually counting what you want to look at. But overall, you know, what we want to see is some overall low inflammation. We want to see those triglyceride levels coming down. I think the level of fish oil that you're taking is probably fine. That's probably plenty. And so that's where I would go. So I wouldn't necessarily blow it off, but it, more from just a position of, let's get a good solid baseline and really collect the data that you need, and then we can kind of go from there. I think one of the things that we're working on, we're trying to get some flow charts to help people kind of troubleshoot what they're up to. And I think one of the things that we need to do is so I started eating paleo and my total cholesterol went up. What does it mean? And you know, then we go and look at, did triglycerides go down? Yes or no. Did C-reactive protein go down? Yes or no. I didn't get that checked. Well, go get it checked. You know, and so there's kind of a matrix or a flow chart that we could put together that would help people kind of weave their way through and establish a really strong sense that they're moving in a favorable direction. And I think that would be helpful for folks. And it would make the data analysis a lot easier.
Yes. Cool. Good question.
Yeah.
I like this next one. Next, we got a question from Darius. He says, I've recently been introduced to paleo diet by my physician. As I've been reading through the book, you recommend eating nuts and eggs, which are two of the many things I'm allergic to. Any suggestions as what I can substitute them for? I was thinking tofu for eggs. Thank you.
Would be horrified by that. Just the lectin load, the estrogen load. I mean, this is one of those things that very simply folks just need to eat some dinner for breakfast. And we've done some really cool stuff with like some breakfast curries. You can make the curries a little bit on the sweet side using some allspice or some cinnamon or something like that. I know in the performance menu, I've published a bunch of recipes that cover breakfast curries. Scotty Hagness has covered some breakfast curries. And then there's also just the basic deal of like you have a hunk of meat and maybe some olive oil on it and a little bit of steamed veggies, or a hunk of meat and some olive oil and call it good. Like every single meal doesn't have to be like a super well-rounded event. So yeah, I would really prefer that you not eat the tofu for breakfast.
Yeah, I think the reason I wanted to put this in is we get a lot of interesting questions about folks like, hey, I can't eat X in the book. I want to substitute something, but they always suggest something that we're not recommending you eating in the book. And I think that
right.
The take home is eat more of what you can eat that's in the book versus going outside what we're saying you should be eating.
Yeah, yeah. It's some of those things in, you know, you think that it's pretty obvious, but apparently it's not. So, yeah.
Yes. this. Cool. Next, we got a question from True Nuts. Hi, Rob and Andy. First of all, keep up the excellent work with your podcast. I'm up to episode 43 after discovering them earlier in the fall and can't get through my 45-minute commute without listening. Rob, I enjoyed your book and posted a helpful review on Amazon, but noticed that you spent significant time devoted to the problems with eating grains. There's only so much information that a reader can digest, pun intended, and I suspect that's why there wasn't a similar level of analysis for dairy, nuts, and legumes. Which brings me to my question, which is based on the following assumption. Let me know if I have oversimplified or am incorrect in making it. One of the fundamental reasons for the adverse nutritional content of grains is that they are basically reproductive embryos, seeds that require protection, anti-nutrients, from ingestion and digestion by animals. As such, I can understand why legumes also contain anti-nutrients, as they are the seeds and fruit of a particular plant family that happens to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere, not soil. However, I'm confused about nuts. Google says that true nuts are generally the seeds of specific trees. Since that is the case, shouldn't they also be significant sources of anti-nutrients designed to protect the nut? What are lectin levels in nuts compared to grains and legumes? I understand the emphasis on eating nuts because our ancestors likely did, and also the favorable omega-3 fatty acid profiles in some. But this seems to go against the grain. Again, pun intended. Needless to say, I'm following gluten-free paleo with an occasional dairy indulgence post-workout and a smart exercise protocol. As a 30-year-old guy, I'm in the best shape of my life. So this is long question. It's more of a curiosity than anything that will change what I should be doing. Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, it's a really good question and a great observation. And this is something that I think, you know, for myself, I it's been an evolution getting to this spot, but we find that people tend to do better with less nut consumption. And I think part of the issue is definitely the lectin content. Like, I think that there's a little GI irritation. I think there's a little kind of systemic inflammation that comes out of this stuff potentially. I like seeing nuts used more as kind of a condiment, as an occasional kind of item that you throw in salads or something like that. When people ask how much they should have, what I've been recommending is that you get whole unshelled almonds and or nuts and then shell them, and or just be very fastidious about how many of them you take in. Similar to grains and legumes, if you soak them and sprout them, then it reduces the lectin load. But you know, it's interesting, like different tree nuts, eggs, similar properties to grains in that they're kind of the reproductive structures. They've got some anti-nutrients, and they tend to be very, very allergenic. And I don't think there's any doubt that these things can be problematic. They're also very nutrient dense, very calorically dense. I think based on who you are and what you have happening, like if you have some significant autoimmune problems or some inflammation or something like that, nuts might be problematic. But this is also part of the deal that when you're introducing this stuff to folks, and I think maybe a podcast or two back, we talked about this with regards to like balsamic vinegar. There are certain things that are just deal breakers when you're trying to get people to do kind of a paleo-esque approach. And the nut deal is one of those things that people need something to snack on. They need something that's kind of a treat, and these are pretty damn good options. And although there may be some issue with regards to the lectin content, if the person doesn't have an overt autoimmune disease, then I'm pretty lax on this, even if they're over consuming the fat content, because it's just getting them over the hump. It's getting them off of all the other really gnarly refined food. It's getting their metabolism shifted a little bit more towards a fat mobilizing metabolism, and then we can maybe wean them down the road towards some better options. And like we've been saying for a while, steering people more towards like olive oil, coconut. Coconut seems to have fewer of these lectin type issues and less of an allergic problem. So that's been kind of the direction I've steered folks. But a really, really good question.
Coconut is magic.
Indeed.
On an unrelated question, Rob, since I'm half looking at Twitter, why I was not listening to you. No, I'm just kidding. did you see our buddy Martin Burka from Lean Gains said he is so effed up on cheesecake today, 13 pounds in all. Best Christmas ever.
Wow. That's aggressive.
Martin is aggressive. I saw that and just, I was like, wow, dude, I couldn't eat 13 pounds of anything, I don't think, right now. But, you know.
You know, cheesecake, though, if there was something I was going to crack out on, cheesecake is up there. Like that's both an aggressive choice and a very good choice. So,
Congrats to Martin. All right.
Indeed.
Moving on. Question from Tom. Hi, Rob and Andy. Faithful listener. Love the book. Think you guys are the greatest thing since grass-fed beef. I like that. Submitted this question in a couple different forms previously, but considering my blood tests continue to show that I'm iron deficient and anemic and my doctors cannot seem to figure out why, I submit the question again for your input. There may be nothing diet related to this, but considering one's iron levels are driven partially by what goes in, maybe diet is playing a role. A 34-year-old male, 170 pounds, CrossFit and strength trained four to five times a week. In July 2009, a blood test at an annual physical indicated that I was iron deficient and anemic. I've had various scans and procedures over the last year and a half with no real success at discovering why. In July 2010, my hemoglobin level was at 9.8. In October, it was at 10.5. And today, December 13th, it was 12.0. I finally gave in and had two iron injections after the October blood test, which seems to have helped raise the number somewhat. My workouts are good. I feel great. I do deal with some digestion problems that have calmed considerably as I lock into a paleo diet. Many thanks.
So my only question really, kicking it off is simply, are you 100% grain, legume, and dairy free? The biggest thing that we see with iron deficiency anemia, even with a lot of osteoporotic issues, is gut irritation. Yeah. If the gut lining is irritated, it is hard as hell to absorb nutrients. And so this is kind of that first thing that I ask. And this isn't, it's so funny where people will get in and it's like, well, I'm 95% compliant and all this stuff. And when we're talking about a nutrient absorption issue, there's either a pass-fail on it. And you either are doing it or you're not doing it. And so if there's any amount of gluten, there's any amount of grains in general, then I'm, legumes also, dairy, potentially problematic. I mean, it's kind of down the list, but this is some of that stuff. Like you do a gut healing, autoimmune focused protocol, no grains, no legumes, no dairy, maybe even tightening things up on the like tomatoes, potatoes, nightshades, like just very, very fastidious on the whole gut healing protocol. And then see where you go from there. If that doesn't work, then what I would start doing is taking anywhere from like 200 to 500 milligrams of vitamin C with your iron-containing meals, as that tends to help the uptake of iron. But I really think that this is probably an issue of good compliance, but not good enough compliance to heal the gut sufficiently to get good absorption.
Yep, I think the common theme is we like to see folks be 100% compliant if possible in the beginning, kind of get the Ferrari running, and then you can see how much crap your body can actually take.
Yeah, like how low grade can you make the fuel without bombing out the high end engine that you produce? So yeah, totally.
Yep, cool, good question. Thank you. Next, we got a question from Bruce. I know you recommend Natural Calm, but I was wondering about the magnesium citrate that is sold as a laxative. Is this the same stuff? Could you just take whatever amount is needed to get the proper dose? And what dose do you recommend?
It is basically the same stuff. In Natural Calm, they have magnesium citrate, they have magnesium oxide and then citric acid. And then when you throw those two things into water, then you get what is the end result ends up being ionic calcium citrate. And so you get a little bit of an acid-base reaction, and then you get the some ionic calcium citrate, and it makes the absorption better. So you could use just kind of like a over-the-counter mag citrate kind of gig. The dosage is anywhere from like 200 to 600 milligrams at a shot, kind of depends on how big you are, how much other magnesium you're getting in dietarily. It definitely functions as a laxative. The magnesium pulls fluid into the stool, so too much is going to be problematic. That's what milk of magnesia is. It is actually magnesium oxide in that case. So you could go with some different options. So the dosing is going to be somewhat dependent on what doesn't loosen up your britches so badly that you're like dashing for the bathroom. But yeah, there are some other options for that.
And when you start this, just like all other things in life, ramp up slowly or you will go to the bathroom.
Yeah, it can be spectacular.
Sure. I had a client that started his Natural Calm on the road, and he called me the next day and, told me the story. And I was like, did I not tell you to take 1/5 the recommended dose? Well, he's like, I just did the whole thing. I'm like, well, user beware.
Especially when you can potentially poop your britches. So, yeah.
Exactly. Cool.
One side thing with that that I'll throw in additionally, Poliquin and some other folks make some mixed magnesium mineral preparations where like they'll have magnesium citrate, magnesium aspartate, different amino acid chelates or organic acid chelates. The theory being that you have different transporters that will act on these different organic acid combinations, and then you can kind of get more magnesium into the system for a given dose before you like saturate one transport mechanism. I'm not super sure on the physiology with that, if that holds water, but there are some folks out there that claim that. So,
yes, and my personal recommendation, Rob, would be before you start playing around with all these fancy combinations of magnesium, 100% paleo diet.
Yeah, shocker.
Get yourself a base, please. Okay.
But if supplements don't fix everything?
If they did, we would be very rich. multi-level marketing with Rob and Andy. All right, next we got a question from Mary. This is a good question. Rob and Andy, now that I've discovered the paleo way of eating, thanks to the podcast and book, I have leaned out and dramatically increased energy levels. I'm interested in starting CrossFit, but I have some concerns. I'm a 45-year-old woman. I'm not extremely fit, although not a couch potato by any means. I'm interested in CrossFit because I can't find the conventional gym I belong to so boring and unappealing, including the classes, yet I find group atmospheres very motivating, and I'm just geeked on the prospect of climbing ropes, lifting, hauling radically heavy objects, smashing balls around, and other fun stuff like that. My goals are to eventually to be able to play hard, especially soccer, with my two young boys as they grow up, to eventually be able to kick my boyfriend's butt in squash, and to live to the age of 90 at least, and to be extremely active and healthy the entire time. Based on the website promo for the CrossFit gym in my area, Montreal, CrossFit is completely scalable to any age and fitness level. Is this really true? The fact that the site also states that a CrossFit wad should totally crush you in order to be effective sort of begs the question. I listen to the podcast regularly, and although you both are CrossFit guys, you do seem to harbor some reservations about the health and longevity benefits of such intensive workouts. I'm interested in both a dramatic bump in fitness and a very long, healthy lifespan. I'm also interested in being able to do my life. I'm a single mom with two young boys, so being crushed by workouts sounds somewhat daunting to me. I'm trying to work out at home, but it's just so uninspiring and so far not particularly effective, and I'm not finding any organized group sport activities for people my age in my area. Now that your book is becoming popular, I bet there are lots of people like me considering CrossFit as an option, and they may have similar concerns. So, do you have any advice or comments about the benefit risks of CrossFit group training for someone like me? Do you think that CrossFit should offer different levels of intensity to better accommodate older participants, or is the concept of scalability sufficient in your option? Keep up the good work, and by the way, you both really need to kick the Java for good. I was like Andy for years with this chronic cycle of caffeine addiction and withdrawal, but finally kicking the habit gave me a major boost. I challenge you all. So, first for you, Mary, I will have you know that one of the major New Year's resolutions for me is to actually finally, including decaf, not have any caffeine.
Wow.
Throwing it out there because, to your point, this cycle is not healthy at all. It's like, I don't know if it was Franklin or Einstein that said for some people moderation is not really an option, and it's just me and caffeine are on that list, so I'm throwing it out there here, Rob, on the podcast, since it'll go up a few days before New Year's Day, so you know, I'll crush myself with some decaf the last 5 days of the year.
I'm doing no such thing, but I have dialed myself back to literally about two shots of espresso a day, and I'm cool with that. I feel pretty good with that, so
I need to on Spreadshirt throw up like a gluten is death, caffeine may be death also shirt or something.
Caffeine is life until it kills you.
And you know what else I was thinking the other day? It's like, you know, when I was a network administrator and worked in IT land, you know, all the guys had these funny shirts with all these, you know, caffeine molecules on their shirts and drank insane amounts of coffee. And I think it's hysterical because that is not generally a very physically fit group of people. And then in a lot of the exercise, CrossFit, whatever you want to call it, you also have these people like mainlining extreme amounts of caffeine. But they're doing it sort of in the name of health and fitness, while the IT folks are doing it in the name of staying up later so they can do more code or watch more movies or video games or whatever they want to do.
It's just kind of a bad idea all the way around.
So anyway,
to our question.
I'll let you start first, Rob. This is a doozy. I like it.
It's a doozy. It's a really good question, though. So, I mean, the fundamental question here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is just like, do I think doing CrossFit is a good idea for folks? And then, there was another question in here. Should CrossFit have some scalability to it? Or, is the scalability enough? In other words, should you have class formats such that anybody could roll in off the street and an 85-year-old woman, an 18-year-old state champion wrestler, and the way that you're going to bring them into your program is to introduce the exact same workout to them, but scale it appropriate for who they are and what they're about. Would you agree that those are kind of the
main questions? Yes.
The main questions. So now, in a broad picture, I think CrossFit is amazing, and obviously, I have my snippy comments, and HQ would definitely like for the Earth to open up and have it swallow me whole. And in some ways, I feel similar feelings towards most of those folks too, but there's this basic deal that, I love the concept. I love the idea of the variety and the intensity and all that. I think back in the day when this was really more an economics-based strength and conditioning program, it was like, what's the minimum dose we can put in and get the maximum response? Back when the front page links talked about things, like the HIIT protocols and Arthur Jones and one set to failure produced similar results as multi-sets and stuff like that. That was some really interesting stuff, and when there was more gymnastics being played around and all that sort of jive. But always the problem that we faced, and I helped open the first gym up in Seattle and coached many people up there before moving down to Chico, and I used that basic program of let's just scale this thing for whoever comes through the front door, and let's use a workout like BAN, which is one of my favorites, 21-15-9 deadlift and handstand push-up. And so the theory would be you have two new people show up on your doorstep, and can you scale that workout appropriate for whoever they are? One person's a state champion wrestler, the other person is an 85-year-old woman. The answer is, yeah, you can scale that. The older woman could be doing deadlifts with a dowel and could do standing press with the same dowel, or maybe like some 5-pound dumbbells. And then, the state champion wrestler, theoretically you do a quick movement screen on them and then you throw them in and let them hit this stuff. But over the course of time, I found that to be so stunningly ineffective as compared to having some sort of a dedicated movement screen, which, Andy's been pretty instrumental in helping to expand what that means within NorCal. But, we had a whole month-long screen and month-long ramp-up called the on-ramp, and it was created in an effort to triage people in many ways, and some people weren't even ready for that scene. Many, many people end up going into personal training because that's the most appropriate thing to do for those folks from an orthopedic standpoint, from a liability standpoint, and then we're able to actually service everybody under the sun in that regard. And so in my opinion, this notion that you can scale things for everybody, can you do it? Yes. Is it the best way to do it? Absolutely not, in my opinion. And I'll argue this both from the quality of service that you could deliver to your clients. I'll also argue it from an economic standpoint. And I'll compare numbers with our gym versus anybody else's gym who is running a different model. And I will guarantee that our model will kick your ass because we're delivering a quality product. And this is one of those things that's just so frustrating that you get slapped down or get pushback from simply arguing for a qualitative stratified triage approach to this sport of fitness. I think that is absolutely nuts. And so if people don't think that this is accurate, if they don't think it's true, and they want to do some comparisons of numbers, like how many people come through the door, how do you triage them, how many of those people do you have a year down the road, what's your dollar per square footage from both the trainers and also for the overarching business, let's do some comparisons on that and see where all that stuff plays out. And then also let's just kind of look at the quality that you get at the end of the day out of that jive. So I'll argue that this is a better story for the client. This is a better story for the trainers working in the gym. This is a better story for the gym in an economic standpoint. It's better quality across the board all the way around with that stuff. And, you know, all of that stuff said, I think that the CrossFit scene, sportive fitness type scenes, function-based group workouts are just phenomenally beneficial. It's an amazing opportunity for community, for networking, for support. The workouts can be fun. They can be, you know, super challenging. They can prepare you for the other things that you have going on in your life. But I think that, you know, including like a health and longevity type of orientation, but I think that there are smarter and dumber ways of tackling this. And I think that some sort of a beginner's program, some sort of a movement screen, being willing to triage people and move them into personal training for both their benefit and, you know, the benefit of the program, you need to have all that stuff in place. So that's some stuff that I would sniff around. Like, do they offer personal training? A lot of CrossFits don't, because they're emulating the old Santa Cruz model of just a group training format. And I think that that's a massive mistake, both for the clients and for the boxes that are running. If they don't offer personal training, there's a serious problem there, in my opinion. And my wife has written on that topic previously, so if folks want some examples of that, I'll just refer them to Nikki's blog. And then if you don't run some sort of a beginner's program, some sort of an on-ramp, if it doesn't last a month at least, I think there's a problem with that. I'll argue vehemently in that regard. Like, most dance classes, most martial arts classes have beginner programs, and or they separate out the beginners from the advanced individuals so that you can establish a base of competency and keep people safe. And I think that that's huge, and it doesn't minimize the potential intensity. It doesn't minimize the community. What it does is it provides an extraordinarily high quality product that you end up keeping people for years and years on end. We have clients that have been with us for now 5 years, you know, and I think that that's phenomenal, and it's very telling to the type of training that we're doing. So, Andy, did I get anything? You want to throw anything else in there?
Well, I did hear it's a Glassmanian market share argument there. But the only my only additional thoughts would be, I know Mary mentioned in here, the site states that a CrossFit WOD should totally crush you in order to be effective, sort of begs the question. So I would say, my personal opinion is that a WOD does not have to totally crush you to be effective. In fact, I think over time we've seen that that may not always be the best approach to get the best results depending on what your goals are. Would you agree with that, Rob?
Yeah, and you know what? And to backtrack a little bit and to actually give a little bit of sympathy to that thing, we as a former CrossFit affiliate, now, you know, doing our own gig, we have always had a little bit of a dual branding challenge. On the one hand, people look at what we're doing and they think it's too damn hard, which we've really worked to make it accessible for just about anybody. But then on the other side of that, you have some people who are legit good solid athletes, and they look at what you're up to and they're kind of like, I don't know, it looks kind of easy. And so there's all, when you have the type of functional training format that we have, and this is a little bit peripheral to what you're mentioning, but I sympathize, I guess, with the plight of gym owners, because you're trying to tell people, yeah, we can accommodate you, but then at the same time, it's not so easy that you're going to be unchallenged. And it's a hard thing to provide both of those messages at the same time.
Yes.
So I will sympathize with that plight. Like, that's a challenge, because you want all of these people in. I think Andy and I were talking about this, and really the kind of defining characteristic of the people that we see is that they're just a little bit adventurous, and they're willing to just give something a shot. Like, they're willing to step outside their comfort zone and just give something a shot, learn something new. And, you know, we have people who have never been athletes before, and then they become quite fit and quite capable. We have people who were athletes before, but they come in and they learn a whole new way of doing things. But the commonality there is that folks are willing to just do something new, and they kind of like empty their cup and take something new in. And I think that that's really more the commonality there. And then people who don't succeed in these scenarios, they're carrying baggage, whether it's I can't succeed, like they just have some notion that they're always going to be overweight or they're never going to be athletic or whatever, and they end up making that true. Or other people were an athlete of one flavor or another, and they can't quite come to terms with being a beginner again. They just want to be on top. And I think that those are the things that end up jettisoning people out of programs like this.
Yep. And so to kind of close this for you, Mary, this is what I think you should do. I would call the local gym. I would set up an appointment to go down there and check it out. I don't know how they operate in our world. We have people come in, free 30 minutes for an hour. We do an assessment, talk to them about their goals, but simply make an appointment, talk to them, and ask them how they would handle you, because I think you ultimately have to feel comfortable working out there. You know, maybe they can show you some clients with similar demographics, at least give you some ideas. I think trainers generally are scared of clients that ask that question, but I think it's important to ask that question, like, hey, you know, you're not totally atypical, but you may be different than some of the folks that you commonly see on their website. So I think, you know, it's a good idea to ask the question, and I think it's a potentially, you know, a great fit for you, assuming it's a smartly run box by people that care about, the client's goals and long-term success.
And, you know, if there is one thing that's good about the ubiquity of the CrossFit scene at this point, you certainly can shop around. Like, you can look around and find other people doing things. Pulican-trained people, CrossFit-trained people. Like, there's a lot of people out there doing good work. So if you don't like the vibe of the first folks that you interact with, keep looking, and you will definitely find a good fit.
Yep. And if it looks like a big warehouse, don't be scared.
our place is a big warehouse, in fact. So, yeah.
But people still like us. So, cool. Good question. All right, Rob, here we go. Are you ready for this one?
This is a good one, yeah.
Question from Aaron. Hey, Rob, recently there have been a number of questions about training for longevity, general health, min investment, max results. In an early podcast, when talking more about elite fitness, you often reference back-off weeks, but I haven't really noticed that you reference them when you are answering questions about training with min investment for max results. So I guess the questions are, one, do you still need to take back-off weeks when you're following, say, a MEB style of training if off days are just filled with leisure activities like yoga, trail walks, sometimes just laying on the couch reading a book? We'll just go through all these. If they're still important, does one need to cycle them in as often? And if less often, then how often would they be prudent? For full disclosure, I follow a strict paleo diet with more than occasional 85% cacao dark chocolate treat, 8 to 9 hours of sleep, supplement with fish oil, vitamin D3, magnesium citrate, have low stress. Thanks to the great work, I look forward to the podcast every week.
Really good question. You know, I think the value of a back-off week is just huge, even when you are otherwise looking at a smartly periodized program. There should be periods where you are consciously doing less than what you think or might even want to do. And then there will be some periods where you really push the envelope and move forward, but there needs to be an ebb and flow with that. And I really recommend that people kind of program that stuff in. What I find, I know for myself, and it's so sad because for years and years and years, I didn't really listen to this. Even when I was doing more the kind of, you know, mainstream CrossFit-esque sort of stuff, had I simply planned my training in a way that, you know, like every third day was a half volume day, every third week was a half volume week, every ninth week was a week off, I would have got more out of it. And then when you add to that better thinking with regards to a focus on skill work and strength orientation and skill orientation, I think it's just that much better. And you just kind of need to look at your own schedule and how you're responding and, you know, build that in. I don't know that there's a perfect template to this, but, you know, play around with something to the effect of, maybe every third workout you do a half-volume workout. And then play with that, you know, then try every second workout, do a half volume workout, maybe every fourth workout, do a half volume workout, play with those things and see what gives you kind of a good return on investment. Maybe even you stagger that a little bit, every second workout, then every third workout, then every fourth workout, and then cycle through that so that there's even a little bit of randomization in that scenario. Ito and I were talking about this, and it's an interesting game to play with, you know, how much can you get away with pushing forward, but it's also a really interesting deal of how much can you keep making progress with while playing with the bare minimum that you're doing. And that's some interesting stuff. And you know, it's funny, there's just nothing new under the sun. If you read Clarence Bass's old stuff, this is exactly the same stuff that he tinkered with, you know. And I think that he was on a once every 12 or 15 days a week weightlifting protocol there for a while, and feeling good and making good progress. And then he would do kind of a Pavel-esque train every single day sort of schedule, but just very abbreviated time. And so there's no perfect answer to this, but I think there's some really ripe fields to be you know, explored with all this stuff.
Yeah, I think the other thing I would throw in is when we work with a lot of folks, you know, when I think of exercise, I think of a long-term lifestyle, and sometimes we interact with folks that are training at such a high intensity and they feel great. Like, we know this isn't sustainable for 10 years, but in their mind they think it is. And so sometimes trying to convince them, hey, like, some of these weeks are better for you in the long run, man. You know, like, you may not feel like 6 months from now they were worth it, but trust us, 6 years from now you'll be glad you took those weeks off, and, you know, or those days off, or half volume days or whatever, and it will be worth it so that you can keep training and feeling good as you age and not feel like you were run over by a car.
Exactly.
And then the only other thing I'd add too is sometimes back off weeks are good, and as you said, volume, and even, you know, periods of slightly lower intensity or lower weight, so people can spend some time mindfully experimenting with their movements. I think when I see folks that are really good at squatting or deadlifting or whatever, you know, not only have they done it a long time, but they spend a little bit of tinkering, you know, with position, with feel, and it's very hard to do that for some folks when you're chasing bigger numbers all the time. But periods where you're a little, you know, less intense, you can kind of tinker with foot positioning and stance and just kind of feel the movement, will help then as you work back with the heavier weights.
Totally. Great question, though.
Yep. There is no one magic program. It's a shame. This is a good question. Question from John, R-E-T-S Wiley. Since this lady has no academic credentials and is slippery in explaining her frequent misinterpretations on the subject, does it affect your view of Lights Out, where she is displayed as the primary author?
This was some interesting stuff. Like, it was my impression that she had a PhD in medical anthropology, and then it's come to light that she doesn't have a PhD. She never even wrapped up a bachelor's degree in anthropology. I still love the content of Lights Out. I still love a lot of the suggestions. Where Wiley has gone of late is this really powerful position in the bioidentical hormone realm, and she has something I think called like the Wiley Protocol or something like that, and she's taken a lot of heat for it and has taken a lot of flack for it. And you know, as a standalone, like Lights Out, I still like a ton. I like the general message. We need to sleep more. We need to sleep in the dark. All that stuff. Keep in mind also, she wrote it with this guy who definitely does have a dual PhD in biophysics and molecular biology. But this was kind of a big wet fish slap over the head. I was like, wow, this, you know, I wasn't aware of this stuff. So it's an interesting development. The Lights Out, it makes me not really question the material in that to any large degree. The information in Sex, Lies, and Menopause, which is so very heavily focused on bioidentical hormone replacement, it gives me some pause in that regard. Yamaguchi, I think, was the co-author with her on the Sex, Lies, and Menopause, and she's a physician who practices out of a kind of alternative cancer treatment center in the Santa Barbara area, I believe. So I haven't checked back on that scene in years, so I don't know if they're still in business. I don't know if they are. Are they doing good business? Are they getting good results? I don't know, but it's some interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, Lights Out is one of those things where the message makes a lot of sense, as you said, and then the results we see with people who actually take it to heart and increase the amount of sleep and sleep in the dark, like, you know, we see some pretty amazing results with folks leaning out quicker and feeling better and all this stuff. So for me, it's like, hey, I still think that's a great book. Sex, Lies, Menopause is a different thing, but then I think the need to sleep more is pretty common sense at this point.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, their combination of, and the, you know, the message, I still just really like that book. Like the message, it seems to dovetail a lot with a lot of what Art Devaney talked about, his early stuff, the sleep, the need for exercise that is beneficial and not a stressor. Like, there's so much good stuff in there, in my opinion. Even if Wiley's credentials aren't what we thought they were, I really think that message is still very, very solid. And again, like, the science has typically been solidified on that. Like, there was a lot of very prescient stuff that has come down the pipe since then, you know, where the follow-up data seems to be very suggestive, you know, sleeping in the dark and all that sort of jive, ketogenic diet for reversing metabolic derangement and whatnot. We've just seen fantastic results with it. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this stuff goes. There's now a website called WileyWatch.org where it's almost kind of that quack watch kind of gig, where they're kind of following her around and trying to, I guess, expose some shenanigans she might be up to. So it's interesting. It's a really interesting deal.
Good. Next, we got a question from Diane. Great seminar yesterday in Woodinville, Washington. I'm beginning to implement my newfound learning into my diet and lifestyle. One question I didn't ask was regarding the oils. Asian cooks will often use a tea oil for stir fry. It is made from compressed tea seeds of the Camellia sinensis tea bush from China. Who knows? Mm-hmm. It is used for high temps to 485 degrees without smoking. It says it is full of omega fatty acids, just not which ones. I have used it and really like it. Does it fall within the paleo plan? Thanks, Diane.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't familiar with this stuff. I did a little digging around on it. It's interesting. It's mainly a monounsaturated fat. So, I mean, it ends up being very, very similar to olive oil in that regard. The polyphenolics in the two are obviously going to be different, the different plant-based constituents in there. Use it, don't use it. One thing about this, like, really high-temperature cooking, it'd make an argument, you know, from the nitrosamine formation and different kind of carcinogenic polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. If you're going to make an argument that there's a way of cooking that's maybe not as good as others, it's high temperature cooking. So from that perspective, it becomes this thing of like, okay, maybe it's low smoke, you know, high temperature oil, which doesn't quite make sense to me given the fact that it's mainly a monounsaturated fat. So I don't know why it's particularly better than, say, like coconut oil or something that's a saturated fat. But that aside, if you want to use it, it seems fine. I think the main omega fat in it is the linoleic acid, the short chain omega 6. So again, somewhat similar to olive oil. I don't see anything magical about it. That's for certain. But if you like it, if it's got a good flavor, whatever, I don't see any problems with it.
We could sell that as magic, though.
I need to do that sometime. Just jump on something and just ride that pony in. Like, no, it does work. You just aren't trying hard enough.
Right. It is like Progenix.
Oh man, I have a story with that. We'll investigate that here in a couple of weeks. There's a whole good thing with that.
Well, and also, I don't know if you saw that, Rob, but on Brian McKenzie's blog, he posted a little story about that last week.
No, I didn't catch that. What was
I haven't read it yet, but I'll send it to you. Somebody sent it to me on Facebook. I'll forward it to you today. I just took a quick look, and it was long. I was like, oh, Lord, this is going to be train wreck. I'll read it later. So if anyone doesn't read Brian McKenzie's blog, go there. I think it's like I Am Unscared or something, Rob. Do you know what it is? I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think that's it.
So anyway, there's a long story about that and some other supplement stuff on that he's kind of sharing his. So also check out the Steroid Times, which has a fun article on Progenics. So anyway, I'm off the reservation right now. Question from Sarah. Hi, Rob. I wish I could have attended your seminar this weekend. It sounds like it was incredibly informative. I'm 28 years old, and I was a vegetarian for 8 years and a vegan for 2 with the help of my trainer, Ruben Baca. So note, I want to thank Ruben right now for digging up a cool study comparing inducing ketosis in dogs versus humans for my brother, and so I appreciate that. And Ruben provided Rob a lot of tequila, I think.
Ruben is a wild man. He is a trainer among trainers. He's great.
So with the help of my trainer, Lier Keith's book, The Vegetarian Myth, and your book, I've transitioned to a paleo diet. My question for you is this. How important is it to include poultry and red meat into my diet? Is it healthy to use only fish as my protein source? I've been using your food matrix and cycling through varieties of fish that you recommend, but have not yet introduced other types of meat. How important is it to include free-range poultry and grass-fed beef?
no need for it at all. I mean, if you like it and want to include it for some variety, then that's fine, but you could totally pull off the fish, shellfish, you know, that scene would be totally fine. No problem with that at all. I would really try to focus on getting wild-caught fish for the most part. If you can't always, then, you know, same deal as a conventional meat, not the end of the day, but nothing's going to be lost from not including poultry and beef and pork and stuff like that. I would personally be very sad never to eat bacon, but, you know, beyond that, you're good to go.
Nothing will be lost but a lot of flavor, Rob.
Yes. details.
No, it's all in the details. Next, yeah. We got a question from Lauren. Hey, Rob and Andy. Keep this as short as possible. I hate the winter, too. Do you think sun lamps will help with winter blues? Are they a waster of money?
I think they could be really beneficial. There's some good studies showing, you know, like the full spectrum lights helping with seasonal affective disorder. Something I need to do a little research on that I want to investigate is what type of vitamin D production, including all the secosteroids, all the peripheral vitamin D-like metabolites that are made from normal sunlight exposure, how much of those are made with like a full spectrum light versus like a tanning booth? What's the production of that stuff in a tanning booth, you know, because of the intensity? What I want to figure out is, you know, what type of light intensity can produce similar results to just standard sunlight? And, you know, there's going to be kind of a cost-benefit trade-off with all that stuff, but that's something that I'd like to do a little research in. But I think that they're definitely valuable.
Question two, I love one or two glasses of red wine with dinner 5 nights a week. Saturday night, I skip the wine and go straight for the hard stuff. I've been rationalizing this due to some study that said women who drink moderately are thinner. I know the Saturday night partying isn't good for the body, but how bad is the red wine? My abs could be better, but other than that, I'm lean enough, and I haven't noticed a decrease in performance. I'm concerned. This is bad for my gut. What are your thoughts?
What's my line out of the paleo solution that, like, if you think that booze consumption, if you're tackling it with some perception that it's healthy, it's kind of like using an adulterous liaison as an excuse for networking. Like, it's a little dodgy. Like, now there are definitely some social elements to it. I think, like, unwinding and relaxing, you know, could be very beneficial. I in all honesty, like, the amount of consumption here is probably well within what you're going to get a beneficial dose response curve out of. That one day a week of serious bendering could undo a lot, but overall I don't think it's that big a deal.
And here is the final question, Rob. I'm 25 and trying to date, but every dude freaks out when I tell them about the paleo diet. I avoid bringing it up for as long as I possibly can, but eventually it comes up. Any ideas on how to sugarcoat this? Yes, I'm asking you for dating advice.
God, we have jumped the shark. What world is it that you've gone to when Rob and Andy are approached for dating advice?
Seriously, people.
You know, I really don't know how to tackle this one. Like, maybe you need to lurk around a CrossFit gym or something like that and find some dude who's into paleo chow. I don't know. I would be stoked by that. My wife was vegan when I found her, and it was an enormous amount of effort on my part to get her on the straight and narrow from there. Had she been some, you know, hard-charging paleo chick, my life would have been a lot easier. So I'm just saying, there's a lot of dudes out there that would be very, very happy by this situation.
Yes. So here is my vote, Rob. I'm not saying this will work, but this is how I would handle it. One, I would never use the term paleo diet again. Mm-hmm. Two, I would not even discuss your dietary choices and just make them. And then if they ask about them, I would simply say you don't feel very well, you know, when you eat X, Y, and Z. And leave it at that, because I feel like for a lot of people, what happens is you have success eating this way, you get super excited, you tell everyone that you can about it, and it gets really annoying and overwhelming, and frankly, some people don't want to hear about it and don't care about it. So
I like it. And you know, if the guy is waffling on this, then you can always just say, dude, all I'm asking you to do is eat more bacon.
Exactly.
And if that doesn't whip him into some sort of, like, reproductive frenzy right there, I just don't know what would.
I mean, I think of this much how some people deal with their families, which is, like, after a while, you don't explain it to him. You just make your choices and you move on. And at some point, he may be ready to have that discussion. And obviously, you know, that's down the road. Like, this is like the thing where we get people talking about when they're dating, when they're 32 and the first date, they're explaining like what they want their wedding to look like. And people are like, whoa,
I'm out.
And this, you know, food is like religion. Don't mess with people's food.
Yeah.
All right, Rob, the final question of 2010. Are you ready?
I am ready for it, man. All right. Everybody else has fallen asleep. They don't care anymore, so let's finish it up.
This is a good one. This is a loop back from an earlier one. So, from Ben, I'm a 29-year-old, 6'2", male, working to reclaim a wasted life. I've always been the fat kid who was terrible at sports, girls, and life in general. High school for me was the worst experience in my life. I was picked on daily and turned to food for comfort. As the years went by, I continued to gain weight until November of 2009 when I realized I was 510-pound waste of humanity. Gave myself two choices, suicide or change. I decided to change. Today I weigh 349 pounds and feel much better. I want to take my lifestyle changes to the next level. In the past month, thanks to the influence of your podcast, I switched to 100% grass beef, wild-caught fish, and local organic produce. Supplement with vitamin D in the mornings and ZMA before bed. I avoid all grains, dairy, and legumes. Soon I'll be adding probiotics to the mix. The next thing I want to accomplish is bringing intelligent training to my life. What would you recommend for someone like me? I would love to try martial arts, but I'm afraid that my saggy skin would be an issue. I'm also very afraid that my personality might not mix well in group environments. I'm usually very reserved and takes a lot of time to get me to open up around others. I'm extremely insecure and lacking in confidence. At work, people think I'm a loner freak, which really bothers me. I would not want to join a group workout setting where the same stigma is attached. The only thing I really have going for me is an overwhelming desire for change. How would your average CrossFit gym handle someone like me? I thought about making an appointment, but I haven't pulled the trigger yet. Would I be better off doing this on my own at a local gym until I have more confidence? Thank you.
Wow. Really, really interesting question. I could, you know, you could tackle this a couple of different ways. I think in the beginning, like, the personal training route is a great way to go with this. You know, and that's one of the benefits of having that for an option. Like, you could check out a couple of CrossFit type gyms. I think the martial arts deal too would be really interesting. I would focus more, if you went more of a martial arts oriented thing, more of like a boxing gym, kickboxing gym, get somebody to do some private training with you that's just skill work and conditioning work. And then on that other side, you know, looking into some sort of a CrossFit S gym, see what the cost is for personal training. And if you can afford that stuff, then I would jump in on that and do it. Like, getting some good exercise and getting some, you know, just getting in your body and feeling good. If you are being this compliant on the food, getting a couple of days a week of some good solid training in will just turbocharge the whole thing. And you'll feel better. You'll look better immediately. I think it would be phenomenal. And then over the course of time, when you start feeling more comfortable, then you could definitely migrate into more of a group class kind of scenario. And you know, you'd only need a couple of days a week of doing some stuff like that, and then just do some stuff on your own, whether it's riding a bike, going for a walk, doing a little bit of a home workout circuit or something like that on your own, just a little bit to supplement on your own, I think would be fine. And just over the course of time, you'll get used to being in this new body. You'll get used to some of the new experiences, get a little more confidence. And at the end of the day, I think realizing that, you know, everybody has insecurities, everybody has baggage, everybody has different areas of competence and weakness. Like, if you ever had me try to work on your car or build something in your house, it's the last day the car would ever drive, you know? I mean, you just have to, I think in some ways, as hard as you are potentially on yourself, just realize that the people around you probably have similar stuff going on, you know, whether they look like they do or not, they do. And I think in some ways that then humanizes the people around you, and you maybe don't feel quite as isolated by the whole process. But I would definitely look into getting some trainer. Get a trainer, find somebody that your personality jives well with them, that you enjoy the vibe, and then run with that. You got any ideas, Andy?
I totally second what you say, and I think similar to the question before is, you know, to find out if you're comfortable with that trainer, you know, ask how they'd handle someone like you. You know, I think it's a big deal in the beginning to make sure you feel comfortable with just a general approach of how they're going to do it, because you're paying them a lot of money and it's a big investment of time and prioritization on your part. And so, you know, I think, you know, meeting with even more than one is a wise idea, because it's a fairly big decision. I always say, like, if you have a surgeon and he's an asshole, it probably doesn't matter as long as he's really good at his job, because you only got to see him maybe once. You know, maybe once in a follow-up. But if you have a trainer, a physical therapist you don't jive with or that you think's an asshole, it's going to be pretty hard, because you're usually going to see them like 2 or 3 hours a week, hopefully for a really long time. So that connection is really, really important, and maybe more important than, you know, anything else that we argue about.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just throw it right out there. Just say, hey, I've never been physically active. I've made a lot of progress, but I'm still not comfortable in my own skin. I have some confidence issues. What do you think of that? And if the trainer or the coach should have a good answer to that. They should have enough empathy to look you in the eye and have a good, thoughtful answer to that. And if they don't, then they find somebody else. Because, you know, this whole strength training, personal training, coaching scene, there are just the best people in the world at it, and they're the worst people in the world at it. But the good ones, you know, the Mike Boyles, the James Fitzgeralds, Michael Rutherfords, those type of people who are just Zen masters of this stuff, that can be an absolutely life transforming experience when you hook up with someone like that. So I would just lay it out there and be completely honest with them. And if they don't have a good answer, then keep shopping.
Yep.
Yeah, but definitely let us know what you do. Like, I'm super intrigued now. I want to know what you're up to, Ben. So give us a follow-up and let us know how you're doing on this.
And with that, Rob, that is the final question of 2010. We survived.
Woohoo!
And anything else you want to say before we shut the year down and prep for 2011?
No, just thanks to Andy Dees and Amber and Matt and Chops and everybody who's been either directly or peripherally associated with the website and the podcast. And thank you to everybody who listens, like all 6 or 8 of you out there. Like, God love you. Thank you for all the support and the huge support that you gave when the book was released and all that. We made New York Times bestseller, and just super excited for the future. Really good stuff going on.
Yep. All right, Rob, with that is the end of 2010 Paleo Solution Podcast, man, episode 60. We'll talk to you in 2011.
Sweet, man. Take care. Right. Don't if something goes awry, don't call me to get you out of jail in Vegas. I will not be available.
It may only be an overdose of high-quality meat, Rob. I think we'll be okay.
There we go.
Cool. All right, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye, Andy.
See you, Rob.